Welcome to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard weekly at this time on 1450 AM and 107.1 FM. Today's guest is Brian Edward Dalton, MD at Tri-State Neurological Surgeons for UPMC Hammond. Doctor, thanks for joining us. What is your medical background?
I attended medical school at SUNY Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse, New York, and subsequently did my general surgery internship at Robert Packer Hospital Guthrie Clinic, and subsequently did my neurosurgical training in Philadelphia at Hahnemann University. I went on and did a pediatric neurosurgery fellowship at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and then returned back to the university where I was on staff teaching residents for a year or so, since I originally planned on being an academic, but soon saw the error in my ways and decided to go into private practice. So I located here, and I've been here since 1990.
Can you tell us about your team and what type of advantages being under the UPMC umbrella brings you guys?
The team that you're referring to would be myself, Steve Gilman, and Dan Lesh, who we have been partners together. Well, Steve joined me right after his residency in the very early 1990s, and Dan came later in the late 1990s, and we've been practicing together since. So we've really been a fixture, I guess would be a great way to describe us, in Erie since the 1990s, and have been a stable practice providing care, and we've kind of gone along with the trends in neurosurgery and kept up. We've serviced both hospitals in the past, but with the changes in the way healthcare is being delivered, one finds the need to choose sides now. So you need to do what's best for the patients and serve the community in the best way with the most resources. And this is how we decided on UPMC, because at this facility, it's really kept up with the times as far as technology is concerned, as well as the healthcare delivery team. We really have a full complement of not only neurosurgical capabilities, but I think it's equally as important when you have people who have neurosurgical problems who by their nature are generally quite sick. You need the critical care medical backup and the general medical care backup that's not available in other institutions. At UPMC Hammett, we have 24/7 coverage with multiple intensivists who do critical care medicine, and that's absolutely necessary when you have critically ill patients, because the problems aren't allowed to wander off course too far, and people have a quicker recovery and more people recover than if you didn't have those kind of services. So it's really nice to have that backup. And I look at it as almost having a safety net under me when I'm working.
Doctor, with your level of specialty, patients don't have to go to big cities to get the kind of care they need, right?
Right. I'm from New York City, and we also had that same idea that if you were sick, you went into what we call the city, which is Manhattan, where all the big universities were. That's not true now in New York, and it's not true in Erie, because when you look at the capabilities at UPMC Hammett now, with very few exceptions, are almost the same capabilities that are available in Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Buffalo. That said, if we do have things that are above our comfort, we have those quaternary resources. We're a tertiary center, the quaternary resources at in Pittsburgh or Cleveland are available. So for the vast majority, 97% plus, it's more than comfortably taken care of here.
Doctor, could you talk about the depth of services you and your team provide?
So if we go back when it was just the three of us in Tri-State Neurological Surgeons, we are all quote-unquote general neurosurgeons, which means we do everything, brain tumors and vascular work, aneurysms and bleeds in the brain and all spine work. And we all had an area of special interest, but we couldn't really subspecialize in that because we were taking care of the community's needs. Now we find ourselves in amongst a very much larger group, and that subspecialty kind of idea is actually now can become a reality. For instance, we'll start with heads. Just with brain tumors, I have a special interest in brain tumors. Dr. Bowden, who's a younger neurosurgeon who's been in ERA, I believe, 3 years or so, very gifted guy, also has a special interest in tumors, but he also has the capability of using Gamma Knife. And Gamma Knife is a technology where X-ray is directed towards a lesion in the head or elsewhere, using computer algorithms and what's called stereotaxic localization. So a computer can make a 3D model of a small lesion deep inside the brain, which would be inoperable because of unacceptable consequences of the operation, deliver a tremendous amount of radiation that would be cidal or kill the tumor itself without affecting a millimeter away from the tumor. So you can literally destroy things kind of like a Star Wars level. And that is good for small primary treatments, for say small metastases from tumors elsewhere in the body. And it's also very useful for follow-up to a surgery in an area where you really wouldn't want to be venturing with an open surgery too far into that area, but you can clean up the edges, if you will, with that kind of technology. So that's tremendously useful. Dr. Quigley, who's a more mature neurosurgeon such as myself, has a special interest, as I do, in minimally invasive spine surgery. So he will go in through, you know, I don't want to make advertisements for other companies, but there's a certain institute on TV that is advertising a small Band-Aid on the back and this little minimally invasive. Well, I've been doing that in Erie since the 1990s, but I don't have commercials about it with a cool advertising company. But Dr. Quigley does this, and that is his main passion. So that expertise is in the area. A lot of the complex spine is done here, where people have horrible spine deformities or progressive spine deformities. We have Dr. Balot likes to do that, as I like to do that as well. And to support that, there's certain technologies that UPMC has invested in, such as a mobile CAT scanner that's in the operating room that allows us to affix a marker array on a patient's spine and then use the same stereotaxic localizing algorithms that I explained with the Gamma Knife, do a CAT scan and reference that point on the spine, so now you can have a 3D representation of the spine superimpose on the x-rays that we have, the CAT scan and the MRI preoperatively, and we can guide the surgery real-time in the operating room after we've gotten the scan real-time. So interventions can be done in a very, very specific manner. Instrumentation such as screws and rods, they go in perfect position. The correction can be perfect, much safer than doing it with fluoroscopy and keeping the anatomy in your mind in the 3D representation, which is what I did for 20 years. This almost makes it simple. I don't want to say simple, but it's so much more comforting to know that you have this 3D representation that gives you the encouragement that you're doing things in an appropriate way. So you wind up being able to be much more complete and a bit more aggressive with the instrumentation. You use larger screws with a better purchase, and you're much more confident in the end of the surgery that you've got a very good solid construct, and ergo the corrections of the deformities are much better.
Can you talk about some of the technologies in the past 10 years that have come along that have made your job a little bit easier?
So since when I started training, and we had to push the stegosauruses off the front lawn of the hospital before I got in, we have seen CAT scan. Okay, so when I started, CAT scanning was new. Now CAT scan, and for one slice, it used to take about 4 minutes to get a picture. Now you can do an entire spiral scan of the entire thorax in 30 seconds and have these beautiful digital pictures. MRIs come out, which allows you not to have to look at the bones. You're looking inside the bones. You're looking inside the canal without the bone in the way. You can see tumors in the spinal cord much better. You can see infiltrative processes. When somebody has back pains and they have an MRI of the back, it's good. You can see the discs and everything. But what it's also showing you is they don't have infiltrative metastatic cancer in the bones. They don't, you know, all the things that when you used to get plain x-rays in the past and you say, oh, maybe we're going to need a myelogram, you couldn't see that there was infiltrating tumor until it started really destroying bone. Building on that, you then started to see navigation, stereotaxic navigation, which was a way to register a patient to a computer in the room, which would allow you to track the patient's head. And with a separate scanner, get the digital information of, say, the patient's brain and load it into the stereotaxic computer. So now the digital information from the MRI will be physically registered to this 3D object, the patient's head, in the operating room. So you can see the tumor through the scalp before you even cut the patient. So then what you can do is, instead of doing these tremendously large flaps, we used to do good big scalp flaps, have to do a big cranial flap, because when I was first trained, we'd take this skull off, opening up the cover of the brain, look at the brain and determine where you were based on the gyral pattern, you know, the folds in the brain, and say, okay, there's frontal lobe, this way. And this is where we'll go, I think it's this way. You know, that's what you used to do. You'd go down and, you know, you really studied anatomy and you had this 3D, you couldn't be a neurosurgeon unless you could think in 3D. You'd go down and 98% of the time you'd find your target pretty quickly. But it was a very, very uncomfortable process, dissecting down to a lesion that's under the cortical surface of the brain until you found it. Then you said, oh, good, I did everything. With the stereotaxic localization, you could plan a much smaller incision, a much smaller bone opening, and then you know exactly how you're going to get there. And most importantly, you can already plan out the approach to the tumor so you avoid really important structures of the brain. You don't want to go through a speech center or a motor center. So you can approach it in a tangential way that would be very uncomfortable in the way I described it, that we did when I was first trained, but do it very effectively, get to the lesion, get it in and get out, and it's much less of an insult to the patient. They recover faster. They can start adjuvant therapy like radiation and chemotherapy much faster. If you do a small linear incision with a minimally invasive craniotomy to get a tumor out, that heals very quickly versus a very large flap and a very large bone flap, and there's a lot of trauma. You can't start radiation in 2 weeks because the wound's got to heal, and flaps, the blood supply to the edge of the flap is a little bit more attenuated because it's such a much more traumatic, bigger process. So that's made a tremendous, tremendous impact. Understanding the biomechanics of the spine and spinal alignment and why earlier surgeries done for spinal problems, although they were successful in the short term, tended to fail in the long term. And we understood that when God has designed this spine with curves in it, and you do a surgery and you make that spine straight in the area where it should be curved, you've now pushed the entire spine above that point forward. So now it's almost like the patient's walking around bent forward. Well, that has consequences for low back pain. It's all muscle. It also causes your neck and your upper back to degenerate faster. So now this whole idea of what's called sagittal balance, the sagittal plane is when you look at somebody from the side of their body, you need to get that balanced. And it seems so commonsensical, but when you look at, you know, the saying is, but for the shoulders of giants, can I see the far shores? The way medical knowledge and technology has evolved, it's based on the steps that have gone before, but there's also, on the negative side, an inherent mindset to how people were thinking then. And it takes a unique individual after they've been out away from their training for about 10 years, and they say, let's look at this a different way. And we have this new technology, and maybe there's another answer because we have this problem that's not getting better. So that's been huge for spinal surgery and just doing things in a less traumatic way. Minimally invasive surgery is the same surgery without the associated trauma to soft tissues that doesn't need to occur. You know, you're doing the same surgery, just doing it in a more elegant manner. Just looking at the pathology backup we have and our concepts of why cancer occurs. You know, I was trained that, you know, cancer occurs because a cell misbehaves and it starts making bad cells. And sometimes they break off and go elsewhere. So what you need to do is cut that out and you separate physically the disease from the patient that's good. What's come around is a tumor occurs because there's a failure of the immune system. Every day in everybody's body, you make thousands of cancer cells. Your body identifies them and destroys them. When a tumor occurs, that process has failed. And the reason why our immune system has turned a blind eye to that particular cell is still a mystery. But a lot of the research done for AIDS has benefited our understanding of the immune system tremendously, because HIV is basically a virus that has affected our immune system tremendously. So a lot of that research has spilled over into many other fields. So now we have this idea, well, you know, this tumor occurs but it's not in one point. You know, for a tumor to metastasize, you got to think about it. Like cells that we're made up of are designed to be in cohesive sheets called tissues. So we have a tumor all of a sudden, and these cells are mobile, and they go through the whole body. Well, how'd they get there? That means they have to move around. So they're activating genes that have not been active since we were embryos, because when we're embryos, the cells kind of move all around. They activate genes so they can get into the blood supply. That means they have to open up a vessel wall, squeeze through, and get into the blood. Then they have to have genes to survive in that environment, because they're not designed to be there. They have to have genes to get out of the blood vessel and set up a foreign, you know, deposit. And they also found, interestingly, people who have had, say, cancers that they're quote-unquote cured from, no clinical disease for 25 years. If you put filters on their blood, there's cancer cells in the blood, but their immune system's just destroying them. And if you look in their bone marrow, there are cancer, quote-unquote, stem cells in the bone marrow. And so that's where a tremendous amount of research is now, so we can understand what exactly is going on there. But that's all Star Wars kind of... I remember the first time I heard that, it was probably about 10 years ago. I said, why didn't everybody think of that? But it's like, it makes so much sense, but our mindset wasn't like that. And I'll give you one final other. I could talk for a couple hours on this. When I was a resident, we would take care of head injuries. I was in the first level one trauma center in the United States, Hahnemann University in Philadelphia. And we had a tremendous number of head injuries. And when you looked at the data from 1960, even through with the Vietnam War and everything, the impact of intracranial pressure monitoring and critical care, we were critical care trained, we had zero impact. The death rate from head injury and the morbidity rate, the people that had serious lasting problems afterwards, was unchanged since they started having statistics. And then somewhere in the 80s, somebody got the bright idea, well, maybe we're measuring a pressure inside the head as an endpoint, but it's really not. It's just a symptom. Maybe we should focus on making sure the brain has oxygen and blood supply and not really worry about the intracranial pressure so much. So this kind of evidence-based treatment began. So we would look at the literature, and the American Board of Neurological Surgeons, it was very forward-thinking here. We graded them 1 to 4 according to the gold standard, a prospective, double-blinded study that follows all the rules. That's level one information. Level two is you really couldn't have it double-blinded, meaning the patient and the investigator didn't know what was going on, or maybe it wasn't prospective. They looked back at their data, but there was some minor flaw. That's two. Three is kind of like they're doing chart reviews, and four is kind of personal opinion. And we just eliminate 3 and 4. You don't even consider that literature. It's just noise. But you look at 1 and 2, and we based all the guidelines for head injury treatment based on 1 and 2. Our results started getting better. Then we came out with brain oxygen monitoring, where you could actually put a probe into the brain of a very sick person and see, are you doing your job? Are you getting that person's sick brain oxygen and blood supply? Because everybody knows if you have any problem with that, particularly within the first 48 hours, the outcome is much more dismal. So that's increased outcome. So that was giant leaps as far as head injury is concerned. So it's really very exciting with all the things that are, and things are still, it's almost like the pace has increased lately. I just sense this. Every time we go to a meeting, there's something else exciting going on in neurosurgery. So it's definitely the specialty to be in.
Sticking with technology, are there any other differentiators that you can speak of?
I think that the differentiator is the fact that we have the team, and collectively there's more experience at UPMC Hammett in neurosurgery collectively than anywhere other than Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Buffalo. Insofar as technology is concerned, everything we talk about technology is you can purchase. Any hospital could have that. Whether they could utilize it because their staff was comfortable with it. And there's a certain learning curve with everything as well. You get a new piece of technology, it gives you wonderful capability, but it also gives you an opportunity to make mistakes you didn't foresee as well. So we're all well past that stage as well. So I think you've got a very nice marriage of very cutting-edge technology at UPMC Hammett, as well as the neurosurgical staff that can use that to your advantage.
What's the difference between neurosurgery and neurointervention?
Well, neurosurgery is the surgical care of patients with diseases involving the brain, spinal cord, and spinal column, as well as peripheral nerve. So pretty much anything that is a nerve, including your brain, spinal cord, and peripheral nerves, like carpal tunnel syndrome and all that kind of business, as well as structures around it, like the skull and the spine, are in the wheelhouse of nerve surgery. Neurointervention is a field where you have radiologists, who are people who generally interpret radiographs taken of the body, that have a special interest in neuro issues, brain, spinal cord, who are invasive in how they deliver their care or do their diagnosis, meaning the neurointervention can go in through blood vessels to get up into, say, the brain, for instance. And if you have an aneurysm, which is a small outpouching off a blood vessel that has burst, say, and they have a hemorrhage, you can treat that with biopen surgery, or you can do this what's called endovascular. Endo means inside, vascular, inside your vessels. They can go up with microcatheters, and they can coil an aneurysm, which is fill it with some material that will make it clot off. And that will save the patient from undergoing an open surgery if, say, they're too ill for an open surgery, if the aneurysm's in an area that would not be suitable for surgery. And sometimes it's just you find aneurysms incidentally. You're getting a test for something else, and it's frankly better for the patient. We have those capabilities. We also, they can go in if somebody's having a stroke. So we have a stroke center at Hammond. If you get in a timely fashion when you're having your stroke and it's determined you have, say, a blood clot blocking a major artery in your head, they can go with a microcatheter and deliver a clot-busting medication, dissolve the clot, and reestablish flow to that area of the brain and save the brain before it has a reversible stroke. Those are the things that neurointervention does.
Doctor, just out of curiosity, what made you fall in love with neurosurgery?
So, in full disclosure, my family either went into art or went into medicine. And so I wanted to be a doctor. And in my mind, I guess I always thought a doctor was a surgeon. You know, my uncle was the head of Manhattan Eye and Ear. He's an ophthalmologist. He's a surgeon. When I was younger, I was trying to think, what kind of surgeon do I want to be? And I thought the nervous system was awesome. So when I went to medical school and I did my electives, I said, I'm going to do elective and everything else and leave neurosurgery for last. So I did ENT, you know, ear, nose, and throat. I did general surgery, and I did internal medicine and cardiology. And my last elective was neurosurgery, and I didn't want to go home. And I said, okay, so that's it. So I didn't look back.
That person that lives with back pain, what do you say to someone to take the initial step to get that checked out?
Well, I think that there's two things. One is there's back pain that's just come on and you don't have a history of back pain, and it's kind of classic low back pain. Most of that is just because you've strained something or it's arthritis and it's self-limited, and with some reasonable conservative care like anti-inflammatories and rest and heat and maybe physical therapy, it goes away. In sharp contrast to people that have numbness down arms or legs or pain shooting down arms or legs or worse yet, weakness. People get very upset about numbness, but it's really weakness that's much more important. That's something you should really see your doctor about. Or any other odd symptoms. You know, all back pain isn't spinal. You can have terrific back pain, and it can be kidney infections. It can be one of the major vessels of your body having an issue and kind of tearing. You can have pancreatic disease. It gives terrific back pain when you have pancreatitis. So if it's really terrific pain, and it's particularly if it's associated with odd symptoms, you got to see your doctor right away. Towards back pain that, say, we'll just limit it to spine issues. Now, my mind, you always try conservative issues because the natural history of back pain from spine is 60% of it, regardless of what you do, is going to go away. Asterisk with time, may take 20 years because it's degenerative disease, but it's benign. It's not going to make you paralyzed. And you know as well as I do, you're of a certain age. You can't wake up in the morning after you're 45 and expect not to have some aches and pains, right? When it gets to the point where it's interfering with your joy in life or your occupation, or you see yourself becoming physically limited or limiting yourself in what you do because of it, then I think it's a reasonable thing to see if you can find what the pain generator is, because most back pain is not surgical. What you want to do is go to somebody who's going to take the time to listen to you, do a thoughtful workup, and see if they can identify what's causing your pain. If you can't identify what's causing your pain, surgery is useless. It's applying a technology just with no target. It's not going to work out. If you can identify the pain generator, maybe there's non-surgical treatment for that, even better. But if it comes down to requiring surgery and the surgeon has a complete understanding of why you have that pain, and then surgery should be very, very effective. So the times when I look back and it's not been successful, very few I can't understand what went wrong, but it's usually that something that wasn't apparent on the first films. People think MRIs are they're not. They don't tell you 100%. You can get an MRI, a CAT scan, plain x-rays, and a nerve conduction EMG and have maybe 80% understanding what's going on. So sometimes there's things in play that weren't apparent. Sometimes injuries don't show up on those studies for some time. They lag behind. Or sometimes it's just I overlook things. You know, I put my pants on one leg at a time too. So when you look back, you say, there was the problem. And then you can address it the second time around. And you got to be open and transparent when people say, I think I missed something here. Or look, that you look at your news study, that this thing wasn't there before. And people will understand that. But I think for me, it's always been, I always thought that if somebody comes in the office and I listen to them, they tell me what's wrong before I even touch them. And as I've gotten older, I have to do less and less of an exam because they've already told me the problem's at L4-5 on the left. And I just got to focus on, you kind of do a screening exam. But I remember early on, I'd have to test every little thing and you didn't know what was important, what wasn't. And all that information went in the hopper and you hoped you'd come up with a diagnosis. Now it's more, I've just found that if you just guide people to let you know the information you need, examine them, and then look at the x-rays. And the x-rays are actually there just to confirm what you already know from listening to them and examining them. If that doesn't happen, there's two steps back, because that's a big negative against surgery. If they don't make sense, you look at the x-rays and, you know, I've had people where they have a great story, a great exam, and look at the x-rays, they're negative. It's crazy. MRI, totally negative. Get a CAT scan myelogram, it looks like a different person because the technology is different and you can see the problem on the CAT scan myelogram. You couldn't see it on the MRI. It's all things like that. So that comes with experience, which gets back to the fact that you need guys with gray hair in the department. So there's a few of us that supply that at Hammett, and a few are the younger guys with the newer technologies. But it comes down to the patient-doctor relationship. And if that's not solid and you don't have communication, you're never going to really be able to get down the road very far.
With all of the advertising that we are inundated with on a regular basis, what should the ultimate takeaway be for the consumer?
I think that's a really good question. And I think it's challenging because advertising sometimes by its nature can be a little disingenuous. Yeah. Just for example, just in neurosurgery, I know billboards and buses running around Erie touting a certain organization that is number one in major neurosurgery. And what they're saying is factually true, because in 2017, when that company that was hired to look at their neurosurgical capabilities did that, my group, Tri-State Neurological Surgeons, happen to be practicing at that hospital. But we haven't been there, and we're at UPMC Hammett, yet that hospital system is advertising our abilities back in 2017. And the average consumer would have no idea about that. And that's disingenuous, but it also kind of confirms that, yes, UPMC Hammett now is number one in major neurosurgery, you know, by the competition says so.
And finally, doctor, if someone wanted to learn more about you and your team, where could they go?
You could go on the web and look at the Tri-State Neurological Surgeons website. There's a ton of information there, as well as very good candid photos. And or I think UPMC Hammett also has a general neurosurgery webpage.
Thanks for listening to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard Fridays at noon. Join us again next week as the Erie Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership is in the business spotlight.